Hello, I'm Anna Maria Tremonti, and you are listening to The Current. You have heard all the predictions over the last few months of a grim future under a new climate regime, but warnings about catastrophic droughts and their consequences already seem like yesterday's news if you're in Australia. Australians have been suffering through a six-year drought, the worst in at least 100 years. And even as Australia sweats through its hottest years in history, many experts expect such droughts will become longer and more frequent with climate change. Some even speculate this could drag on for another 40 years. No one has felt the effects of drought more acutely than Australia's farmers. Cattle ranches that have been in families for generations are being abandoned. Wool production is at 60-year lows. And perhaps unsurprisingly, then, there has been an alarming increase in the rate of depression and even suicide among farmers, succumbing to the stress of wilting crops, dying livestock, and accumulating debt. Now, drought is no longer just an agricultural issue. It has become a mental health crisis in Australia. Journalist Nicola Fell has visited some people dealing with the toll that drought has taken on farmers, from mental health workers to the farmer that we are going to, who we are going to meet now, Bill Nessner, on his cattle and sheep station in central New South Wales, Australia.
Here they're crutching sheep. That's done twice a year to clip the wool away from their tails so they don't get soiled and then fly blown.
How many sheep have you got?
2,000.
Can we maybe go for a bit of a tour?
Yeah.
Just a bit around,
I'll just do a quick circuit here, then go back to the house that way because there's a few cattle here I just want to check on. We're going to sell these cattle on Friday.
Why are you selling them?
We can't keep them anymore because the feed's getting very sparse now. If we keep them any longer, they'll get thinner, so the time to sell them is now.
Unless it's rain.
Oh, if it rains, we keep them, but it's not going to rain. Oh, we've got 3,200 acres here. In hectares, that's about 1,300 hectares. 110 cows and 2,000 sheep. It's very good wheat growing land, and the only trouble is we don't get enough rain. Well, we haven't done the last 5 or 6 years. It's just been continual drought. And the only income we've had really is from the sale of wool and cattle and sheep. Every year, the difference between what you get and what you spend is getting less and less. So a lot of people, I think when the drought breaks, I think a lot of people are going to sell out. I'd hate to let the farming in our family die out because I don't know, it's just something I'm a bit sentimental about it, I suppose. Just about full. I just checked the water to see how much was in there because when it gets down to about here, you've got to turn the pump on again. You've got to check it every couple of days because if the cattle run out of water, that'd be really serious, especially those with young calves, because their milk would dry up and the calves would die.
What examples have you seen on the farm of climate change?
The sun's just so fierce now and so damaging. At one time, if we got over 40 degrees, that'd be an exception, but now you can go 10, 14, 21 days with temperatures over 40 degrees. Before climate change, we used to get nice steady rain that used to soak in and cover a wide area. Now it's just damaging rain that causes soil erosion because it falls so heavily. And we seem to get more wind now too. You get a lot of wind erosion. That's a worrying sign to see the good soil you've got, which you haven't got much of on top, getting blown away. I heard the story once of a man up in Queensland. He spent all day putting his cattle through a chute, shooting them as they went through because he had to, because he didn't have any more feed left. He just shot them and shot them and shot them and shot them. At the end of the day, he had one bullet left and he shot himself.
My name's Gordon Parker and I'm the executive director of the Black Dog Institute. There is a common statistic talked about that 3 or 4 farmers will kill themselves each week in Australia. But that statistic is dated. We actually don't know the current rate. We know that rates of depression are higher in rural areas. We also know, importantly, that suicide rates are distinctly higher in rural rather than city areas, and particularly in young males aged between 18 and 25. And we also know some of the reasons. One of the studies done by a member of our team showed that in areas, rural areas where the population was above 3,000 and had always been above 3,000, then the suicide rate was just slightly above the Sydney rate. The most interesting domain, however, was where the population in that area had been above 3,000 but had dropped below 3,000, where the suicide rate in young males was 5 to 10 times higher than that in the city. And the model that we'd take from that is that when rural areas start to die, then in fact often young people will act out the death of the town. And so they see their hopes and aspirations disappearing. Maybe the families had to sell the farm. Maybe they can't get away, and so on and so forth. So rural people do have high rates of depression, and one of the key markers of depression is suicide.
Are you surprised that there's higher rates of depression and suicide on kind of rural areas and in farms?
Not surprised. The thing about farmers is that they work on their own all day, every day, on their own. And I think that contributes to depression. A feeling of hopelessness because you don't know what you're doing here. You're not going anywhere. You can't see the farm improving at all. You're just still making sure the sheep don't die, the cattle don't die. When it rains, you put the crop in. But then you see your life ebbing away and you wonder what it's all been about anyway. And that adds to depression.
My name's Glenn Smith. I have lived with bipolar disorder for about 40 years. Just recently there was an ad for people who have had experience of depression to talk to audiences of people in regional and remote areas where people may not have much of an understanding of these sorts of illnesses. In order to help some of the people who are suffering from the prolonged drought that we've been experiencing here. Some of them have turned to taking their own lives, and the feeling is that if we can get these men in particular to understand what is happening to them and to come in and seek some help.
I've struggled with depression since 1989 when I got tinnitus. That's continual ringing in the ears.
Would you say that the droughts made things like tougher?
Yeah, because of the fact that I can see no point in my being here. The years go past, I get older and older, and I seem to be marking time. I'm holding the fort, but I'm not going anywhere. I mean, every year you go past, you've ticked another year off, you're still financially solvent, just. But it's just another year of just holding the fort. That makes you depressed.
Well, that is the farmer Bill Nessner, and we've been listening to a documentary prepared for The Current by the journalist Nicola Fell. Well, we have been listening to people for whom climate change isn't just a threat, it is a reality. So if you think climate change is a hot-button political issue in Canada, check out Australian politics. Even as the drought worsens and climate change threatens everything from Australia's Great Barrier Reef to its wine industry, Prime Minister John Howard remains unrepentant about refusing to sign on to the Kyoto Protocol. He's feeling the heat from the opposition Labor and Green parties, both of which have made climate change their ballot issue for the upcoming federal elections later this year. Mr. Howard is even getting pressure from former World Bank chief economist Nicholas Stern, who chided Australia for not taking stronger action on greenhouse gas emissions. If anything, Mr. Howard has dug in his heels, saying economic development takes precedence over targets on emissions reductions. Contrast that with the man the Australian people voted Australian of the Year in January. Not a pop singer, not an athlete or someone who wrestles crocodiles, but Tim Flannery, the author of the best-selling book The Weathermakers, How We Are Changing the Planet and What That Means for Life on Earth. Tim Flannery is in our Toronto studio. Hello, welcome back to The Current.
Thank you very much and good morning.
I'd like to pick up again on the crisis in Australian agriculture. When you think about this drought, what does climate change mean for the future of cattle ranching and those iconic sheep stations in Australia?
You know, we all keep hoping for rain. We all keep hoping the conditions will go back to what they were. All indications are that that's not going to happen. Just to give you a sense of how severe this drought is, 100% of the state of Victoria, which has traditionally been our wettest state, has been declared in drought. 100%. That means that every primary producer in Victoria can put their hand up for some government assistance to help them tide through this difficult time. But we can't see the end to the difficult time.
I want to talk a little bit more about how dire the water situation is in Australia. How is it being felt in the cities, first of all?
There is not a city in Australia, with perhaps the exception of Darwin, that isn't suffering some sort of water restrictions or water rationing. Now, at the mild end of the scale, that means you can no longer wash your car with your hose, or you can no longer water the garden, or perhaps you can only do it 1 hour a week. But at the other end of the scale, it means that there is water rationing, that people have got 100 litres a day in some of the country towns to get by, and that's because all of their water has to be trucked in, freighted in by truck or by freight train. It's not that our rainfall has declined precipitously, although it's declined somewhat. We're getting 10% less rain now than we did in the 1950s.
Mm-hmm.
What's really occurred is that the rain that does fall now is just not making its way into our dams and rivers. That 10% rainfall decline has translated into a 70% decline in stream flow. And that's happened because Australia's warmed up with climate change. The soils are hotter, the plants are more stressed. So whatever water does fall on our soils is now more likely to evaporate from the soils directly or transpire through trees. So, when you're getting 70% decline in stream flows, that is just catastrophic. Well, for cities that depend upon dams, for irrigators that need that water in the streams, there's no groundwater, there's no water in the streams.
Well, a report earlier this year has suggested the biggest river system in Australia, the Murray-Darling River Basin, is in deep trouble. What can you tell us about that basin?
Well, about 18 months ago, I took a little aluminium runabout right down that river system. Farms that I visited at that time, orchards particularly, growing oranges and this sort of thing, I've had correspondence with some of the people I visited 18 months ago, and the river is dry. No water in the Darling River. Overall, stream flows in that river system are at one quarter of the worst flows ever recorded in history. We've got a city of 1 million people at the mouth of the Murray River. It's a city called Adelaide, dependent upon that water supply. People are now launching emergency measures to rescue native fish in that river because some species, it's feared, will become extinct if we don't move.
How badly is Australia being hit by climate change compared to other parts of the world?
It's hitting us where it really hurts. So water availability, our Great Barrier Reef is devastated. And, every year with the warming, we see more damage to that wonderful piece of our natural heritage. We're seeing now the next round, I think, of species extinctions in Australia. We've got a bad record of extinctions in my country, but beginning 50 years ago, we started to set up national parks and start to care for our fauna and flora better. But starting in about 2002, 2003, a number of relatively common species have begun a dramatic decline again.
Well, which ones are at risk?
There's a little marsupial, which is a creature that's rather similar to the ancestor of all of the kangaroos that's been living up in the alpine country for many, many millions of years. It's restricted now to the high rocky slopes, and its population has declined by over 90% just in the last few years. And you can understand why. There's just no snow. And so that animal depends upon the snowpack to keep it warm in winter.
What's happening with kangaroos?
In the centre of Australia, 2 years ago now, we had a very hot episode where thousands and thousands of kangaroos and emus died. And they tend to migrate, when it gets very hot and dry, those animals will try to move out. But we have a number of fences in Australia, the rabbit fence, the dingo fence, and these sort of things that help pastoralists but are a barrier to species migration.
Mm-hmm.
And we saw carcasses piled up against those fences for thousands of kilometres where these conditions had just got too extreme for these animals.
So they were going to try to get over the barrier because they were looking for another place to go.
Trying to head south to where it's a little bit cooler and where there's some more water.
Mm.
And this year, we had a problem with camels, and camels are the hardiest of the desert animals. But they were being driven crazy by thirst and walking into the middle of Aboriginal settlements. And we're seeing some significant changes as these temperatures really ramp up.
Now, you mentioned the Great Barrier Reef. The United Nations Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change has reported that the Great Barrier Reef is in danger of being functionally extinct by mid-century during warming waters. What's actually happening?
The Great Barrier Reef is developed on a very shallow marine platform, and that's why it's there. There's a lot of sort of seabed which is lit by the sun, and so these corals can grow. But that water doesn't it can't cool as readily as other parts of the ocean because it's this big shallow platform and the sun beats down on it and warms it up. As the water warms, the symbiotic relationship that keeps a coral reef alive breaks down. And that relationship is between a little coral polyp, like a little sea anemone,
mm-hmm.
and some algae that live in the tissues of that polyp. Normally it works that the little algae can photosynthesize effectively at moderate temperatures and give something back to the polyp, and the polyp helps the algae. Once temperatures increase, photosynthesis is impaired on the part of those algae, and somehow the coral polyp senses this and ejects the algae from its body. And at that point, the coral reef goes white, so it's bleached, you know, because all the colour is in the algae. If that warm water persists for a month or 6 weeks, then the coral organisms, those little polyps, just starve to death. And that's what we've seen over massive areas of the reef. In 2002, 60% of the reef was damaged by this phenomenon. And so it goes on.
What would it mean for Australia and Australians if that reef is to die off?
Well, my goodness, I mean, just in terms of tourism, it would be a huge blow to our economy. Fisheries would vanish. But the biggest blow really would, I think, be one to our psychology. You know, Australians are very proud of their natural environment. It in a sense, it is the source of our nationalism. You know, we live on an island continent that's very different from the rest of the world, and being Australian means smelling the gum trees, seeing the kangaroos, and enjoying this wonderful biodiversity. And to have it damaged in that way, I think, would be quite a blow to our sense of ourselves.
So what will your country look like by mid-century? What will it feel like? What will be drastically changed?
Look, I don't know. You know, if current trends continue, so if we just base it on that, we would have a much drier continent. We'll lose our irrigation. We'll have much less productive rangelands. I don't know where our cities will be getting their water from or how we'll be making a living. The old saying was, you know, Australia was a quarry and a farm. You know, we're still a quarry for China while it continues to develop. Whether we can continue to be a farm is a more open question.
At this point, how much does Australia need to talk about adaptation to climate change then?
That is the most difficult question. And I say that because I see what happens at these rates of climate change in parts of the world that can't adapt. And East Africa is suffering a drought similar on scale to that of Australia. In our drought, we give farmers relief, you know, financial assistance from government, and we truck water where it's required. In rural Africa, you can't do that, and people just die. And so when we talk about adaptation, I'm acutely aware that while us Australians may be able to adapt, we can't afford to leave those five poor people behind for every one rich person that can adapt. That is genocide. So I'm not quite sure what the answer is. I do know that this is a global problem. It can only be dealt with globally. So as we move forward to adapt or whatever else, it is simply not right to leave those other people out to say, we can adapt, we'll be okay, you guys look after yourself. Mm-hmm. It's not morally acceptable.
But if you get to a point where you have to adapt, each country has to adapt differently, right? What could Australia do?
Well, I guess, you know, farmers would tell you we'd grow crops that would survive in drier conditions. We could put in desalinization plants around our cities and produce our water that way, and those things will probably happen, that sort of adaptation around the margins.
From the look on your face, I can see that's just, you don't want to have to pick that option at this point.
No, because it's not necessary as yet. All of our efforts need to be going into mitigation at the moment. And of course we've got to do some adaptation around the edges, like help our farmers survive through this. But we need a major effort to reduce our emissions and get the gas out of the air.
You have suggested that Australia should establish a city in the desert and make that the centre of the Australian electrical grid. Can you tell us about that?
Yes. Look, at the moment what we do is we have the highest dependency in the world on burning coal for our electricity generation, which is crazy. We're so blessed in other resources, solar, wind, geothermal, particularly geothermal. And there's one deposit alone in Central Australia that's been surveyed for its geothermal potential. And it has enough embedded energy in it to run the entire Australian economy for a century at about the price of the coal we burn now. So what I'm suggesting is that if we want to continue to be a quarry, which looks like that's our future, and we want some minerals processing, we've got to do it with emissions-free electricity.
So you'd build a city where you could take advantage of the geothermal power.
That's right, right in the centre of Australia, and cluster a heavy industry using clean technology around that, and use that city as the centre for a true national rail grid, and also for a national electricity grid. So, you know, decommission the coal-fired power plants, turn to the energy sources that are going to give us a future.
At the same time, there are those people who say it's not a great idea ecologically to build a city in the middle of a desert. Where would you get the water?
Look, I just say to them, let's not make the perfect an enemy of the good. If someone can come up with a better system or better idea, be happy to listen to it. But as we move forward with this, we've got to realise we're dealing with a very acute emergency. And we'll need to get behind some sort of plan that'll move us swiftly to a low emissions economy.
You know, everything we've been talking about and the fact that the Prime Minister has recently agreed that climate change does pose a threat to Australia, I'm wondering what you make of the Howard government's refusal to take stronger action.
During the decade that we've been arguing about Kyoto, and Australia is one of two countries now that haven't ratified, the amount of human-caused pollution has got 20% worse. So that's the cost of the Howard government's delay so far. And what that's also meant is that the actions we have to take now have to be that much more dramatic. Had we started a decade ago, it may have been that a carbon trading system would be sufficient to start seeing significant impacts. That's no longer the case.
Well, one of his arguments, of course, and one that opponents of Kyoto bring up all the time, is that it is pointless because it doesn't include countries like China and India, and it is these developing world economies that are using so many coal-fired power plants.
China and India have ratified. They're not obliged to take on reductions under this first period, but they're part of the treaty. And this is a global problem that will only be solved using global solutions. And the only one we have of those at the moment is Kyoto. So you listen to the Chinese rhetoric now, and they're saying, why should we do anything in the next round? Because the US and Australia still haven't done anything.
And how much of the China that coal in India are burning comes from Australia?
I believe it's on the order of 5%. I'm not 100% sure about that, but we are the world's largest coal exporter. So we've got an industry there worth $20-odd billion a year that is cooking the planet.
And how much does that industry play into the government's reluctance to act more decisively on climate change?
I think it's probably the single most important reason, that the aluminium smelters, the fossil fuel industry in general.
And I've been reading reports that the Howard government is pressuring low-lying Pacific Island nations to tone down their calls for stronger action against climate change. Can you talk to us about that? What's going on there?
We have a number of small Pacific Island states that are quite dependent upon Australia for foreign aid. And the government has been pushing them not to use international forums to raise the issue of climate change. And one of our bureaucrats, in fact, said, look, it'd be just easier for these people's islands to go under the water than for us to wean ourselves from our coal dependency. So don't try to change Australian industry. Let these guys migrate and live somewhere else, which was the most appalling thing I've ever heard an Australian say.
Well, is the Australian government in sync with the Australian public on climate change?
No. On many, many issues, no.
Enough to get elected, obviously, but...
Yeah, but that was, the latest polling suggests that 70% of Australians see climate change as the single biggest threat facing us, and that we want something done, even if it comes at an economic cost.
How would you compare the Australian and the Canadian governments in terms of their positions and policies, the basic ones on climate change?
They are very closely linked and probably each other's closest natural allies in the world, I suspect, these two conservative governments. And we're seeing very, very similar, not only policies, but phraseology. The words seem to translate very instantaneously from Australia to Canada.
Phraseology such as what?
Oh, I'm a climate realist. That was one that I read here first in the Globe and Mail, and instantly our Prime Minister had picked it up and was running with it as his little tagline. There's a very close link, not only, in fact, with the government, but the right-wing media in Australia and Canada. It's amazing how quickly things flow between the two countries.
There are scientific experts who have been calling on climate scientists to tone down some of their wording, their rhetoric, if you will, about impending environmental apocalypse because it is alarmist in their view and unnecessary. Some would say that your book is as scary as anything out there. How would you respond to that concern?
Well, what I did was, with that book, simply take the science as it was published up to 2005. So the core of the book is the scientific discoveries published in the world's foremost science journals, and reported them as objectively as I could. I deliberately stayed away from that shrill environmental tone. I wanted the science to be able to speak for itself. The book came out of, in part, my experience of advising a government. So you don't use alarmist language when you're advising a government. So I don't think my book is alarmist in any sense. Some of the information in it's alarming.
So the idea that it's scary, I guess your argument is that what we face is scary.
That's right. And look, I believe no one can see the future. But, you know, I think that even if it's 10% probability that the worst outcome will happen, it more than justifies taking a very vigorous approach to the issue.
Tim Flannery, thanks for coming in today.
Thank you.
Tim Flannery is the author of The Weathermakers and a new version of the book for teen readers called We Are the Weathermakers. He was in our Toronto studio.